Hello there, and thank you for listening to this Pro Bono Students Canada podcast. Before the show starts, I'd like to say that the views expressed on this show do not necessarily reflect the views of the producers, host, or the Queen's University Faculty of Law. This podcast does not contain any legal advice. Pro Bono Students Canada is a student organization. This podcast was prepared with the assistance of PBSC Queen's Law student volunteers. PBSC students are not lawyers, and they're not authorized to provide any legal advice. This podcast contains general discussion of certain legal and legally related issues. If you require legal advice, please consult with a lawyer. With that in mind, let's dive into the case of Nevsun Resources Limited v. Araya, and how its ruling may be understood as having quietly, but meaningfully, shifted how Canadian courts approach international law. Nevsun is a Canadian-owned mining company. We're being accused in a Canadian court of human rights abuses that they committed in the course of their operations abroad. How does a Canadian court approach this? When courts are asked to confront allegations of international human rights abuses, the instinct is often to ask a moral question. What happened? Who was harmed? Who should be held responsible? And perhaps even, how should they be held responsible? But before any of these questions can be answered, there's a quieter and more technical question that must come first. How does international law operate when it appears in a Canadian courtroom? Is it something that has to be proven, like a fact? Or is it something that can be recognized and applied, like domestic law? That process and evidentiary question, often invisible to non-lawyers, sits at the very top and at the very core of the Nevsun case. How the Supreme Court answered it may matter just as much as anything it said about corporate accountability or human rights. The factual allegations and their context. To understand why Nevsun ever made its way to a Canadian courtroom, it's necessary to say a bit about the country of Eritrea and the economic and political environment in which this litigation arose. Nevsun Resources operated a gold mine in Eritrea, the Bisha mine, which by the late 2010s had become one of the most economically significant industrial projects in the country. According to Eritrean economic reporting, the Bisha mine alone contributed close to 20% of Eritrea's total GDP. In a state with very few major revenue sources, this mine was not peripheral, it was central. That economic reality matters, because Eritrea is widely understood to be a totalitarian state. Political dissent is suppressed, independently courts are effectively non-existent, and the population lives under a constant surveillance and fear of government reprisal. Many Eritreans live in deep poverty, and the state maintains control not only through law, but through coercion and enforced dependency. Central to that system is Eritrea's National Service Program. On paper, it resembles compulsory service. In practice, it's been described by international observers as a system of indefinite forced labor. Eritreans are automatically enlisted when they turn 18 and assigned to whatever work the state chooses for them. The government does not meaningfully consider a person's skills, preferences, or safety. Individuals may be sent to factories, sanitation work, construction, or agriculture labor. Others may be forced to continue schooling, not as an opportunity, but as an obligation, training to become doctors, judges, or administrators for the state. Crucially, the people placed into positions of authority, police officers, judges, supervisors, are often those the state believes it can most easily manipulate or coerce. Power is distributed not based on merit, but on control. It was within this system that Nevsun's mining operations were carried out in the early 2010s. According to the plaintiffs, who were laborers at the Bisha mine, they were drawn directly from the National Service Program. These workers allegedly labored 12 hours a day for 6 days a week, with that seventh day of the week being a six-hour workday. All of this work being done in the extreme heat of an Eritrean desert. The allegations concerning working conditions were severe. Workers who were late, disobedient, or who attempted to escape were allegedly hogtied, beaten, and forced to roll naked in the sand as punishment. These allegations did not come from a single source, but from a collective of Eritrean refugees who later escaped to Ethiopia, Sudan, England, and Germany. Using these accounts, a Canadian human rights law firm brought the case to a British Columbia court, alleging that a Canadian company had benefited from slave labor and other grave human rights abuses. This context explains something critical about Nevsun. This litigation did not arise because Canadian courts were eager to police the world. It arose because no other forum was realistically available. Without mechanisms of transnational justice, without the willingness of domestic courts to hear claims connected to their own corporations, atrocities such as forced labor, torture, or even murder, when economically beneficial to foreign enterprises, may never be heard at all. And if unheard, they're almost certainly unpunished. This is the policy backdrop against which the Supreme Court's procedural and evidentiary choices must be understood. This brings us to a deeper policy concern about Nevsun. If Canadian corporations are permitted to structure their operations so that the most coercive and abusive conduct occurs just beyond Canada's borders, insulated by a foreign state with weak or non-existent legal systems, then corporate accountability becomes optional. The plaintiff's argument was not that Canadian law should replace Eritrean law. It's that Canadian corporations should not be governed solely by the law of states that systematically violate human rights. Despite that being the argument, that's not what the courts were being asked to determine. So what was it? It's crucial to understand what Nevsun was and was not about. At the Supreme Court, there was no trial. There's no findings of fact. There's no credibility assessments. Nevsun brought a motion to strike. They argued that the plaintiff's claims should be dismissed at the outset. The applicable test was whether it was plain and obvious that the claim had no reasonable chance of success. But embedded within that procedural posture was a deeper issue, one with significant policy implications. How should Canadian courts approach international law when it's pleaded as a part of a civil claim? That question affects not only outcomes, but also how counsel frames their arguments, how judges reason through disputes, and what courts consider themselves entitled to know without proof. In Canadian courts, foreign law, meaning the domestic law of another sovereign state, is treated as a fact. If a party wishes to rely on it, it must be proven, typically through expert evidence, and it's subject to evidentiary rules and cross-examination. International law has, at times, been treated in a similar manner. The majority of the Supreme Court in Nevsun pushes firmly in the opposite direction. The majority held that public international law, including treaties and customary international law, should generally be treated as law, not fact, for the purposes of Canadian adjudication. That distinction matters enormously. If something is treated as fact, it must be proven through evidence. It becomes subject to admissibility rules, and it may be challenged through cross-examination. If something is treated as law, courts may take judicial notice of it. No formal proof is required, and counsel will argue it's an authority, not testimony. For the Nevsun case, the claims brought forth through international law were to belong in this second category. They were to be treated as law. The decision written by Justice Abella focused specifically on customary international law, or CIL. Before turning to customary international law, it helps to situate it within the broader architecture of international law. Unlike treaties, which bind states only when they've been formally consented or general principles and judicial decisions, which operate more as interpretive guides. Customary international law emerges from what states actually do, and from their shared understanding of what they are legally required to do. The court reaffirmed a long-standing principle of Canadian law. Established norms of customary international law are automatically incorporated into Canadian common law, unless they conflict with legislation. This means that norms such as the prohibition of slavery, the prohibition of forced labor, and the prohibition of torture are not foreign imports or aspirational ideals. They are already a part of the legal framework within which Canadian courts operate. And because they are law, courts are entitled and required to judicially notice them. No expert evidence is required to prove that torture is prohibited. No witness is needed to establish that forced labor violates international law. These are legal premises, not factual assertions. This is one of Nevsun's most understated yet consequential contributions. By treating established customary international law as law rather than fact, the court does three very important things for future human rights claims. It simplifies how these claims may be pleaded. It clarifies how counsel should present international norms. And it reduces procedural barriers that might otherwise prevent claims from ever being heard. International law no longer needs to arrive in Canadian courts disguised as expert opinion. It can arrive openly, cited, interpreted, and debated as law. This does not mean that every international claim will succeed. It just means that courts no longer assume they're incapable of knowing the law of an international community. From a policy perspective, this reflects a judicial willingness to engage with globalization rather than retreat from it. In this case, the majority and the dissent did have competing institutional concerns. The majority reasons, which were authored by Justice Abella, emphasized access to justice and doctrinal coherence as its underlying principles. The majority expressed concerns that treating established international norms as matters requiring proof would create unnecessary procedural barriers and risk insulating serious allegations from judicial scrutiny altogether. By contrast, the dissenting judges, Justice Brown, Roe, and Cote, raised institutional and separation of powers concerns. They warned that allowing novel international law claims to proceed could create uncertainty for Canadian businesses, improperly expand the role of courts, and draw the judiciary into matters better left to legislatures or international bodies. Importantly, the dissent did not deny the existence of customary international law. Rather, it cautioned against courts moving too quickly in recognizing new causes of action grounded in it. Crucially, for both the majority and the dissent, the Nevsun decision does not suggest that all international law must always be judicially noticed. The court acknowledged a potential exception for new or novel claims of customary international law. These cases may include emerging norms, contested or controversial rules, or alleged obligations lacking settled recognition. In such cases, courts may appropriately require evidence of state practice, often through expert testimony, subject to the usual rules of admissibility. This preserves flexibility and restraint. It allows courts to distinguish between well-established norms requiring no proof and genuinely contested claims that demand evidentiary grounding. The result is not doctrinal recklessness, but procedural discipline. Why does this matter, then, beyond Nevsun? Nevsun is often discussed as a case about corporate accountability, and it is that. But it's also a case about judicial confidence. Confidence that Canadian courts can identify established international norms, treat them as law, and apply them without pretending that they're foreign facts, requiring some sort of translation. This shift affects how international law enters domestic litigation, not only in human rights cases, but potentially in areas such as environmental harm, armed conflict, and transnational corporate conduct. It reshapes pleadings. It reshapes advocacy, and it reshapes what courts are willing to say that they already know. The three Eritrean plaintiffs achieved a significant procedural and doctrinal victory when the ruling in February 2020 dismissed Nevsun's motion to strike claim. It was not plain and obvious that the plaintiff's claim, including those grounded in customary international law, had no reasonable prospect of success. The outcome ensured that the plaintiffs would have the opportunity to present evidence and advance their claims in a full trial setting in British Columbia. In principle, Canadian courts were ready to adjudicate civil law claims, alleging serious human rights violations committed abroad and linked to a Canadian corporation. A private-to-private matter, which occurred in Eritrea, to be tried in a BC court. How interesting. Unfortunately, interesting for us, with this case, kind of stops here. The parties did not proceed to trial. In October 2020, Nevsun Resources and the plaintiffs reached a confidential, out-of-court settlement. While the terms of that settlement were, of course, not disclosed, the resolution brought the litigation to a close and avoided a judicial determination on the merits. The principle of the Supreme Court decision remains, though. Nevsun does not guarantee justice. It does not eliminate legal hurdles, and it does not transform Canadian courts into global tribunals. But it does do something quieter, and perhaps more enduring. It tells us that international law is not something that Canadian courts must be convinced exists. It's something that they already are entitled to recognize. And once a court accepts that, once it's acknowledged that some norms are so fundamental that they require no proof, the law's imagination expands. Not recklessly, but deliberately. Before we end the show, I'd like to say that the views expressed on this show do not necessarily reflect the views of the producers, host, or Queen's University Faculty of Law. This podcast does not contain any legal advice. Pro Bono Students Canada is a student organization. This podcast was prepared with the assistance of PBSC Queen's Law student volunteers. PBSC students are not lawyers, and they are not authorized to provide legal advice. The podcast contains general discussion of certain legal and legally related issues. If you require legal advice, please consult a lawyer. Thank you for listening.